And he told me what I was going to have to do if I got his business. And it took him about 5 minutes to tell me. And when he got through, I said, Morris, I think you got me wrong. You're talking like I came out here to sell you something. I didn't. I came out here to help you if I can. And if I can't, you're busy and so am I. And he leaned back in his chair and he says, I know it, Charlie. And I put it in the market for him, some $75,000. And when his market opened, a bunch of these people that were on the balcony were out there to see the opening, you know, which all the vendors did in those days. And I showed up, and they grabbed me, and they took me off in the corner, and they says, Charlie, I was Charlie in business. Says, that was the greatest piece of reverse psychology that we've ever seen. Says, we've been talking about it ever since. That's what I'm talking about. Well, he says, we heard you. Said, you went in there to see Morris. And he says, I'm ready to sell. And you come out with a $75,000 order. Greatest piece of reverse psychology that we've ever seen. I said, what the hell are you talking about? If that guy was subject to reverse psychology, he wouldn't have the $2 million to put this thing in. He knows more about reverse psychology than all of us put together. I told him the simple, unadulterated truth, and he knew it. That's what I'm talking about. He knew it. I said, you think you got me wrong. You think I came out here to sell you something. I didn't. I'm here to help you if I can, and if I can't, you're busy, and so am I. And I met every syllable of it, and he knew it. You see, this thing we call the truth is a very powerful thing. It's the most powerful force on earth. And there's no barter in it. Now, people sat across the desk from me for 25 years. First, they would tell me, you're a damn liar. Business cannot be done this way. You're a damn liar. And they didn't even make me mad. I just laughed. Because they didn't know something I knew. Because I'd been doing it that way for 10 years. And it was all right. So I just went ahead doing it. And pretty soon they were coming in. Everybody in like business. We would call them competitors if we called anybody competitors, but I didn't have any competitors. Because I wasn't competing with anybody. I was just helping my people do things they need to have done because I wanted to. And everybody came in the last few years who were like business. And they sit down and they say to me, how do you do these things? You know. The ones that told me I was a damn liar. Because they couldn't even bid the business I was working with, you know. They'd go to see Bonds and they'd say, look, you're putting in this new market. I want to bid on it. They'd say, Charlie's going to put it in. They'd say, what do you mean? I said, Charlie's going to put it in. Well, he said, how do you know he's not going to take the right teeth? You got to have some bids to compare. Charlie's going to put it in. Says it costs money to bid one of these jobs. Go see somebody else. And so they started coming in and see me. And they'd say, how do you do these things? Well, I'd take 2 hours out and I'd tell them. I'd tell them exactly Ned needs them, and I got his number now. I'll fix him. I know how he does it. I'll get him. But they didn't get me. Neither did they get the business. Because, you see, they weren't motivated as I was. They weren't motivated. They thought you had to outthink, outperform, and outmaneuver. I knew better. Because I did it that way 30 years and ended up in the bottom of the snake pit. And I did it for free and for fun, helping God's kids do things they needed to have done because I wanted to. For 25 years, and I got rich. And I wasn't even trying to get rich. They made me rich. Now, I'm going to tell you a couple other things, because nearly all you guys are still in business. And you know very well that this is impossible. So, you can say when you get through, well, I heard that mutt, but he's a liar. You know? A couple of my Jewish friends had a market at Crenshaw and 101 called Pooch Company. Now these boys were a couple of youngsters about your age. I had done business with their dad years before when they were little bitty kids running around the store. And I did business with them. And they wanted to change the fixtures in the liquor department. And they had an architect. Designer. Designed some fixtures and stuff. And called me and says, come down and take a look at this. Tell me what they're worth. And I went and looked at them. And I said, hey, this guy's drawing up some pretty fancy stuff. I'd never drawn you up anything that fancy because it's very expensive. Well, he says, what do you think it's going to cost? And there weren't many of them. And I says, my guess is it cost you $4,500. He says, put them in. And I put them in. And they were in the store and he had them working. They were doing a good job for him. And I had my cost in. And I had $5,700 in it. My money, $5,700. And I called Abe and I said, Abe, do you remember what I quoted you for those fixtures? And he said, no, but he says, I suppose I have it written down here someplace on my desk. Well, I says, don't look for it. I'll tell you, it's $4,500. And I says, Abe, you can have them for $4,500. They're in your store and they're doing a good job. And you can have them for $4,500 because that's what I guessed on them. But I was wrong. I had $5,700 in those fixtures. He says, Charlie had a profit and sent me the bill. And I says, don't want that. I made the mistake. But I would like to get my money out of it. He says, Charlie, put a profit on it and send me a bill and I'll pay you. I said, no, but I'll bill you for $5,700 if that's all right with you. He says, if that's the way you want to do it. Now, you know better than that. Nobody would do that. I billed him $5,700 and paid. I had another outfit that I did business with. The last deal I put in for them was it's called Pride Center. And it was Fallbrook and Victory out in the West Valley. And it was a big deal. And we put it in and it was opened and it was running about maybe 90 days. Did a good job. Beautiful thing. Then Dave Shore called me one day and he says, Charlie, you haven't billed me. And I said, no, Dave. I didn't know what to bid you. But I've got the costs in now, and I can get it together for you pretty fast. He says, how fast? I says, probably an hour, I can call you back. Well, he says, please do. We want to finance this thing. And we have to know the amount. So call me back, Scrooge, again, and now I have a dope for it. And I called him, and I said, Dave, are you sitting down? And he says, yeah. I says, are you alone in the office? He says, no, Charlie's sitting across the desk from me. I says, your heart all right? He says, I've had no trouble with it. Well, I says, here it comes. You owe me $225,000. And he says, well, isn't that too bad? He says, I just wrote on a slip of paper $225,000 and handed it over to Charlie across the desk. He says, you ought to hire me as an estimator to send me a bill. Now, you know that's wrong. He's got to say, well, how about sales tax? You can take off the sales tax? Not a word. Send me a bill. I was in trouble. 1958. It was a bad trouble. And I had to have some business. I had a vacant plant. And it cost me $13,500 a week to keep the doors open. And I had to get some business, so I went out to get it. And I had five deals that I thought I could get. Deals that I'd worked on, and it looked like they were mine. And I went to get them. And one after another, they evaporated. But the last one could not evaporate. Because the two owners of the deal were members of Alcoholics Anonymous. 28 of their high echelon were members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was poor child. And that was my deal, and it couldn't be anybody else's deal because I'd done all their thinking, all their planning, everything I'd gotten the deal together for. And it was mine. And I went down to get it. And about four or five of us went to lunch and had a good time down at Welch's on Atlantic. Came back and everybody left like rats from a sinking ship. There's nobody left but Harold Hodges and myself, and we went into his office and I reached for the money. And he says, Chuck, he says, I thought you could never get yourself out of that mess you were in up there. And I give this deal to Hill. And it was the last one. Don't win anymore. And about 5 minutes later, he says, Chuck, why don't you say something? I says, well, there's nothing to say. And I went out and started to drive back to town. Their office was in Long Beach. My plant was at 40th and Alameda, and I couldn't drive, so I drove off the road. And I sat there and I looked at myself for a while and I couldn't get myself together. Here everything had just evaporated right in front of my eyes. And I finally came to see that here I had gone out for the first time in years to get some business. 12 years before, I'd started making 12-step calls in business, helping people do things they need to have done because I wanted to. And here, there was a pinch, and I had to go get it. And I went out there to get it. And everything evaporated. And I said to myself, can't get any worse. Why don't you start making 12-step calls in business like he did 12 years ago. Let the chips fall where they may. So I gave the business back to my partner and started making 12-step calls. And here's something that every one of you will know is impossible. Even those who aren't in business, the judges will know this is no good. Where's that judge? Oh, there he is. He was pretty good this morning when you guys weren't here. So, I got back to the office, and either that day or the next, I got a call from the guy in San Bernardino. And he says, "Charlie, I have the feeling you're in trouble." And I have written out a check for $50,000 in your name, and it's lying here on this desk. You don't sign a note. You don't pay any interest. We'll apply it to the next deal we have. Come and get it if you need it. I don't know whether you do or not, but I have the feeling. I says, "I'm going to Miami tonight. I'm going to be going a week to the SMI Institute." That was the Supermarket Institute. "You can either come and get it now, or you can come after I get back." And boy, I'm telling you something. That was something. And I says, "Milton, go ahead to Miami. And if I need it when you come back, I'll come and get it. But I want you to know that I'll never forget what you've just said to me. It's beautiful." And by the time he got back from Miami, I didn't need it. The place had filled up, and it was full until I sold it. Now, gentlemen, what am I talking about? Am I trying to tell you how good I am? No, sir. No, sir. I'm trying to tell you how good this is. The gift of God was made at the foundations of the earth. In my book, God hasn't got anything to give me. Not because he hasn't got anything, but because he already did. The gift of God was made at the foundation of the earth. He gave us the universe. He gave us himself at the foundation of the earth. When I was sitting in that same chair sitting now, with everything gone, the blackest moment of my life, the universe was mine. God was mine, and all that he had was mine. He knew it, but I didn't. I had to discover it. And being an alcoholic, I had to discover it in my own way and in my own time. God loved me just as much that day as he does now. Just the same. No different. But he never kept me from making mistakes. He's a gentleman, God. He don't intrude where he's not wanted. So, he never kept me from making mistakes. He loved me enough to allow me to make my own mistakes, that I might the sooner run out of my own resources and come back home where I belong. So, my business is to go about his business. And it's his business to take care of me. That is not my business. That's his business. Now, what is his business that I'm going about? helping his kids do things they need to have done because I want to. A 12-step call in business, a 12-step call at home, a 12-step call in AA, a 12-step call in play. Just worry about our Father's business. That's my business. It's his business to take care of me. And he's done an infinitely better job than I ever did. And I'm most grateful. Now we talked about prayer a little this morning. Wondering why we didn't start these meetings and close them maybe with prayer. And I told you, as far as I'm concerned, this is a prayer. This is a prayer. My life is a prayer. If you'd ask me what's your religion, I would say it's the way I live. That's my religion. Don't make any difference what I call myself. It's the way I live. That's my religion. And so, that's my business, to go about his business. Because I want to. Now, there are a couple of little things that I learned many, many years ago that fit right into this picture. There's an old Upanishad that comes out of India. Most of you scholars know about the Upanishads and the Vedas of India. I had a guy down Palm Springs when we were down there last who was a Vedantist. And he was telling me what a bunch of butchers we were in AA as far as spiritual things were concerned. He was telling me that we had to purify our hearts. So we would be worthy to see God. We had to purify our hearts. I said, yeah. I said, I was through that route myself. I purified the hell out of my heart. And the purer I got, the drunker I got. I said, you know something, bud? I'm sitting here living too, and I see God. And he didn't know what I was talking about. He couldn't know, you know. Because he thought there was another thing, and there was four different things you got to do. Yogi this, and yogi that, and yogi these two things. And you yogi yourself right into a purified spirit. Then you see God. I'm sure glad that that ain't the way it is. I'm sure glad that the God that there is not anything like the God that I was told about. I'm most happy about that. Now this Upanishad says this: the whole world is the garment of the Lord. Renounce it and receive it back as a gift of God. What does it mean? It means that as long as these things were important to me, I couldn't have them. I beat my brains out for 30 years to get the things I thought I was born without, and ended up in the bottom of the snake pit. Now, I wasn't a fast buck artist. I wasn't a confidence man. I worked hard to get. And I ended up in the bottom of the snake pit. And then I put in 25 years trying to add two. And all the things I beat my brains out to get are mine, and infinitely more so. When they're unimportant to me, they belong to me. The whole world is the garment of the Lord. Renounce it and receive it back as a gift of God. It's beautiful. And they say another thing. They say that anything that's worth doing is an end in itself. That anything that's done as a means to an end is self-robbery. Now, what does that mean? I had, we'll say, 50 men working for me. 35 of them worked for a paycheck. They lost 5 days and left 2 out of every week. They worked for a paycheck. 15 of them worked for fun. They had a picnic. They never lost any time. And they were my premium men. They got more money than anybody else. And they lived 7 days a week. Lost no time. Anything done as a means to an end is self-robbery. Even to be good for something is self-robbery. Even if it's being good to go to heaven. It's pretty good motivation. But it's self-robbery. Because there's no barter in this deal. No barter at all. We do it for free and for fun because we love it. It's fascinating. To be good for nothing. This is the freedom of life. Just to be good for nothing. That's not self-robbery. That's for fun and for free. Now, I said a while ago, in my opinion, the gift of God was made the foundation of the earth. I'm not the first guy that's ever said that. It's written, "Fear not, little flock, it's the Father's good pleasure to give us the kingdom. Fear not, little flock, it's the Father's good pleasure to give us the kingdom." I don't say you've got to earn it. It is written, "Take no thought of the morrow, what you shall eat, what you shall drink, or wherewithal you shall be clothed. Your heavenly Father knoweth what you have need of before you ask him." It is written, "Whatsoever you desire when you pray, believe that you have it, and you'll receive it." Now, how in the world are you going to believe that you got something that you ain't got? How are you going to believe it? There's a trick to it. You got to know that the gift of God was made the foundation of the earth. That God's will for you, his child, is fulfillment, peace, and joy. And that every good and perfect gift is from his hand. So, when we recognize this, then we know that what we might pray for is already ours. It's already ours. The gift of God to his kid. No barter. Now, lastly, for this session, I'm doing pretty good. You know, I'm holding the time limit right, pretty nearly on the dot. This is a new deal for me. It's reported in the fellowship. They say, "What comes after Chamberlain?" And they say, "Tuesday." You know how I'm ending up right on time. The easy way is the right way. The tough way is the wrong way. There's an easy way and a hard way to do this program. The hard way is to try to do it yourself. The easy way is to know that you can't.
to know that you can't, to recognize the need for help. Now, I have never asked God one time in 29 years to keep me sober. Never asked him once. I've thanked him a million times, but I've never asked him once to keep me sober. Because that's not the way I read my book. The way I read my book, it says, here are the steps we took. When we took them, something happens. When we don't took them, nothing happens. So, I told Father Barney, I said, I've never asked God to keep me sober. He says, why not? I said, I think that's not his business. I think it's my business to do these things. It's his business to take care of them. And he does it. I don't have to tell him what to do about his business. And you guys told me what to do about mine. And I do it. Here are the steps I take. I'm sober. And many, many good things have happened in my life, including the disappearance of the related disorders, which I didn't spend 5 seconds on. Not 5 seconds did I spend trying to get my wife back, or the kids, or my job, or my health, or my sanity. And somehow or another, it sort of all fell together. So God's will for you and for me is fulfillment, peace, and joy. The gift of God was made at the foundation of the earth. What you came here looking for, you came looking with. But we have to find it where it is. And it's right here. And it's an inside job. It's an inside job. Uncovering, discovering, and discarding is Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a fascinating way of life, and it gets better for 29 years to my certain knowledge. And I suspect it's going to get better forever. World without end. Amen. God bless you all. That's it.
We have talked about the fact that everything that we were conditioned to believe was true about life in home, school, and church has had to be reversed since we grew up a little bit. And of course, this includes getting out of our own way. Self-discovery. It includes surrender when we were conditioned to believe that surrender was for the weak. Strong man wins, weak man surrenders. So, we had to run our own lives. We had to win the battle. In this new way of life, we have nothing to win, nothing to prove. And we're not going anyplace. Nothing to win, nothing to prove, and we're not going anyplace. Now, I am either going to run my life and take the consequences thereof, or I'm not going to run it and take the consequences thereof. One of the other of those things I must do. We cannot do both. Again, it's written that you can't serve two masters. Either you cling to the one and despise the other, or vice versa. A house divided against itself can't stand. So either I'm going to run my life and take the consequences thereof, or I'm not going to run it and take the consequences thereof. And they don't mix. And I can't run mine. As we have said, we had 43 years to run the show, during which time I was the star of the show and the master of ceremonies. And after 43 years, I had accomplished failure in every department of life. So I can't run my life. I can't run nothing. Can't run my business, can't run my wife, can't run my kids. Can't run anything. And I knew it. I knew it when I got here. I came here knowing that I had lost the battle of life. And I had given it everything I had. I gave it my wife, my kids, our home, my job, my health, my sanity, and my money. And I lost. So I can't run my life. It's no big deal as far as I'm concerned, however. Because I don't need to. Because I've lived for 29 years in total expectance of guidance and direction. So, I don't need to run my life. It isn't necessary. And I can't. And I accept it. Now, the next premise is that God is either sufficient unto all of my needs, or He is not sufficient unto all of my needs. One or the other. If He is not sufficient unto all my needs, there's nothing to worry about. Because in that case, life is not worth the candle. The sooner it's over, the better. We might as well knock this thing off and go down with the bus and fill it full of liquor and shack up. And drink till we die. If God is not sufficient unto all our needs, sooner it's over the better. There's nothing to recommend life. So if He is not sufficient, there's nothing to worry about. And if He is sufficient unto all my needs, there's nothing to worry about. So I got you both ways. Got you both ways. Because if He is, all I have to do is to act like His kid and prove that I am. And that's written like this. Act as though I am, and I will be, saith the Lord. Act as though I am, and I will be. So, that's all I have to do. To act as if it were true and prove that it is true. And that's what we do in this program of ours. There's nothing else to do. There's nothing else to do because we've already lost. We've already been to human power. The best I went to, the priest, the preacher, the doctor, and as we said, to the guy who knew more psychiatry than there is. And every one of them talked to me about willpower, backbone, stand up, being a man. Every one of them. Because, you see, prior to 29 years ago, almost nobody knew anything about alcoholism. The people I went to see, the authorities, did not know anything about alcoholism. And they couldn't help me. And I didn't know anything about alcoholism, and I couldn't help myself. So I had to keep right on drinking until the bottle killed me before I could even come here to investigate. Now, I knew that my job, my problem was not the lack of willpower or the lack of backbone or the lack of being able to stand up and be a man. I knew that. I was born with a pitchfork in my hand. I can't remember when I wasn't working. I always worked. And I was a pretty good athlete in my day. And I can say that without fear of successful contradiction, because there's nobody here old enough to remember. And my backbone had never given me the slightest trouble. And you know something? It hasn't yet. My backbone does a hell of a job for me. If everything I have worked as well as my backbone, I'd be in top shape. If you want to make a question on that, talk to me tomorrow about it. So, it isn't backbone. It most certainly isn't willpower. If there is ever a group of people on the face of the earth who has willpower, it's the drunks of the world. But we got willpower to burn. I could get whiskey in Kansas on election day if it fell on Sunday. It depended only on how high I was walking off the sidewalk, how long it took. Any place in the country. If the need was great, it didn't take very long to get a jug. Every time I hear these earth people talking about backbone, willpower, I want to ask them one question. How many of them ever crawled a mile in the mud after dark just to get a bucket of ice? Part of the course, we're drunk, you know. We got willpower to burn. And in the standing up and being a man department, we can give them cards and spades. If there's ever a bunch of philosophers on the face of the earth, it's the drunks of the world. We have all the answers for everybody but us. One of our great assets, one of the things that really endeared us to the non-alcoholic world. We have always known exactly what was wrong with him. And we didn't mind telling him. And that's not a good way to win friends and influence people either. We're a great bunch of philosophers. You could go right now into any bar in this part of the country and ask the first drunk that you bumped into any question that popped in your head, and he'd tell you. He wouldn't stammer and stutter. He wouldn't say, "I don't know." He'd tell you. Great bunch of philosophers. So,
I knew all the time that my problem was not willpower, backbone, standing up and being a man. But I didn't know what it was. So, I had to keep right on drinking until I died before I could come here and find out. Now, this isn't any criticism of the doctors or the preachers or the priests or the psychiatrists, because they didn't know. And back in those days, they did not know. It's a comparatively recent thing that doctors and priests and preachers and psychiatrists, a great percentage of them, have made it their business to find out something about the disease of alcoholism. And they can presently tell us and tell us where we can go for help. But in my day, this was not true. Thank God. There's so much more known about it today than there was then, that many people can find out and come without having to destroy themselves, as some of us did. However, Mrs. C. says to me quite often, supposing I had have known something about Al-Anon back in the days when you were drinking, supposing Al-Anon would have had have been here, and I was in it, and I would have known a little bit more about how to handle you or how to treat you, not handle me, but how to treat me. Do you think that it would hasten you into the society before you came? And I say, I don't really believe it would have. In my case, I don't really believe it would have. Because I am one who certainly could not hear till I could hear, and could not see until I could see. As I told you the other day, I read Jack Alexander's article in the Post in 41, and 5 years later, I remembered that I'd read it. I was four sheets in the wind when I read it. And I remembered only two things about it, that drunks helped drunks and didn't drink. And they called it Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's why I said to myself, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I'll find AA. And from the decision until now, I haven't had a drink. So I don't know. In my own case, up until my last drunk, it was never my fault that I drank. Up until my last drunk, and I got drunk for 25 years. And I was a periodic for the last 10. And I was physically a sober them tonight between every two drunks for 10 years. And I could look at my record with physically sober eyes for that whole 10 years. And yet until my last drunk, it was never my fault that I drank. It was your fault. It was my wife's fault. It was her mother's fault. Now, there was a king-sized reason for getting drunk, that mother-in-law of mine. Reminds me of a little story I picked up from Al Badger in Dallas. Al's gone to the big meeting. He's a hell of a guy. He was about 3 or 4 months before me in the program. He was soberly died a year or so ago. And he was a great storyteller, and he told this story. He said there's two drunks who met on the street. And one of them says the other, how's things? Oh, he says, not good. Well, he says, that's bad.
He says, not so bad. He says, I got married. But he says, that's good. He says, not so good. He says, I got my mother-in-law, too. Well, he says, that's bad. He says, not so bad. She's got money. He says, that's good. He says, not so good. She wants to boss everything. He says, that's bad. He says, not so bad. She bought us a house. He says, that's good. He says, not so good. The house burned down. Well, he says, that sure is bad. He says, not bad, brother. He says, she burned, too. And so that last excuse has got to go to the boards. It's got to burn up. If you and I have one excuse left that is still acceptable to us, we have another drunk left. Nobody is going to do the things necessary to obtain and maintain sobriety. If there is any way to pin this on to anybody else, your mother-in-law or your boss or anybody else, we're not going to do it. In my own case, I don't remember if I told you this down here or not. I've told it many, many times. But on my next to last drunk, when I went to the kitchen after a glass of buttermilk, Dick and Miss C were sitting in the living room. They heard me let out a beller and heard me hit the floor. Came running out thinking that I was in an alcoholic convulsion, but I wasn't. I was just lying there on the kitchen floor as peaceful as anybody ever saw. Doing nothing, but they couldn't wake me up. And they tell me I was a peculiar color. I was blue. They got all exercised and called the oxygen squad. And they came down. And after a while, they woke me up. And they told me that, to all intents and purposes, I'd been dead. That they'd had a hell of a time bringing me to, and nobody'd ever bring me to again under those circumstances. And they told me if they were me, they wouldn't do that anymore. I remember I told you that. But I did it again. But the thing I want to tell about this time is this. That about 24, 36 hours after they'd brought me to, I was able to get the old dirty bathrobe on and start walking off this drunk. Now, that's the way I had to sober up. I never heard of an easy way to sober up until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. The only way I could sober up was to die until I could live. And I did it mainly walking. Now I've got the old bathrobe on and I'm walking up and down the living room floor, back and forth, sweating, freezing, shaking, dying, and walking. Miss C was standing over the fireplace. And I was walking away from her. And she said, Chuck, don't you think you might get a little help if you'd read the book Alcoholics Anonymous? And I turned on her like a lion. I said, you, my very own wife, suggesting that I read a book written by a bunch of drunks. I who have read all the good books for the good authors. And you want me, why, I says, you wound me deeply. Now, I'd just been dead 48 hours before. And she wounded me deeply. And I polished her off completely by saying, and besides, I can write a better book than that myself. Now, that was just 90 days before I came calling into this program. Just 90 days. I'd been getting drunk for 25 years. And she wounded me deeply by suggesting that I read this book. So I doubt very much if there was any way that I could have gotten here except the way I came. And that was through totally burn up. Which happened to me in my last time out. Now, many times people hearing a guy like me, or some of you, who had everything happen to him that can happen to anybody, and they say, well, those things didn't happen to me. I've never been in jail. I've never had DTs. I've never had convulsions. I've never had trouble with elephants. You know, I had a lot of trouble with elephants. I may be one of the few people that ever lived in Beverly Hills that were charged by a herd of elephants. That almost never happens in Beverly Hills. They're running me right out of the town. No convulsions. I've had them all. And they say, well, those things happened to me, therefore I'm not an alcoholic. Now we think that there's no degrees of alcoholism. You can either drink well or you can't. One or the other. Alcoholism is a great deal like pregnancy. A gal don't get any more pregnant in 8.5 months than she was 15 seconds after conception. It just shows more. Same thing's true with us. I don't think we get more alcoholic. I think it just shows more as time goes on. And it don't make any difference how many of those things you've missed. You know whether or not you can drink well. And if you can't drink well, you might be an alcoholic. We say in this dealy of ours, if alcohol interferes with your personal life, your business life, or your social life, any one of these three, maybe, any two perhaps, and the three of them, you're a cinch. But there's another little question that I like better than all three of those. And it's very, very simple. Is it necessary for you to wonder whether or not you're an alcoholic? If you are, sign up with the secretary before you leave. I have never caught a non-alcoholic wondering whether or not they were an alcoholic in 29 years. It's always been an alky that's trying to figure out some way to beat this rap. So it isn't how much or where or when. It's what it does for you. I'm mindful of a number of years back. We had a doctor in San Francisco, quite a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a gynecologist. As a matter of fact, he was 5 times a doctor. He was a doctor, a surgeon, an obstetrician, a gynecologist, and a psychiatrist. He was qualified in all those fields. And he told us a little story. He said he was operating a lady who was getting pretty well along in years, past 60. And he had determined in her examination that her arterial tree was very weak. And he had also determined that she'd never had a drink of liquor in her life. And for post-operative care, he prescribed a little brandy. And they started giving this biddy a little brandy. And he said, on the third day after the operation, she stole the keys from the nurse and got into the brandy. And she'd never had a drink in her life up until that time. So so. It's not how much or how long. It's what it does to us, you know. And you can either drink well or you can't. And if you can't, this program is for you. And the quicker you embrace it, and the quicker you do something about it, the better. Because alcoholism gets worse, never better, in its manifestation. I'm actually 29 years worse off so far as successfully drinking liquor is concerned than I was when I got here. And I know it. I know it. And I don't have to take a drink to prove it. But because I've been close to and active in this program for the whole time I've been here. And when you're close to and active in, all you got to do is keep your eyes open. Your friends are forever taking that drink for you. And you don't have to take it. They do your experimenting for you if you keep your eyes open. Now, there are two or three little things that I want to add to this before I take off. When I first got here, I was quite sure that people who had not suffered as much as I had suffered couldn't possibly love this thing as much as I did. And I felt a little bit sorry for those who came and hadn't had some of the things happen to them that I had happen to me. Because I knew that they didn't, you know, they couldn't feel this thing like that. Until I got to working with J.B. Priest. Never been kicked out of anything. Was still serving the altar. But he was a priest. A J.B. at that. And it gradually dawned on me that I was a drunken nobody. Nobody gave a damn whether I drank or didn't. Half a dozen people. But a Jesuit priest, how much they must suffer in doing a bad job. And I got to working with my banker. And he was one of the biggest bankers in the country. He was an internationally known banker. He taught banking. He was a dollar-a-year man with the United States government for quite a while. And he'd never been kicked out of anything. He belonged to everything in town. Never been kicked out of his home. He lived in Fremont Place. He could only get in there and out one way. No cross streets, no out to the other end. You go in and out the same way. It's private. That's where he lived. And he'd never been kicked out of home. Never been kicked out of anything. But he couldn't drink well. And he wasn't doing his job well. And he came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And when the time came, when he felt that he had to start trying to give this thing away, he went to his committee. He was chairman of the executive committee of one of the biggest banks in the city. And he went to the committee and he says, "Look, I have an alcoholic problem. And I have found a way that might let me live for the rest of my life without drinking. And one of the things we must do is to work with alcoholics." And he says, "I'm going to have to start working a bit with alcoholics because they've worked with me. And I'm sober. And I'm going to have to talk a bit. And people might know. And it might be damaging to this bank. And so I'm submitting my resignation to this committee right now for your action." And they says, "Go to your office." And he went out. And he was almost to his office when they opened the door and called him back. And they says, whatever you feel that is necessary for you to do, do. And we're with you 1,000%. Isn't that beautiful? And this was one of the most humble men I've ever known in my entire life. Up until the time he died. He's the guy that allowed me to buy my business. Beautiful, beautiful man. And we used to sit between Christmas and New Year's every year and have lunch in the California Club, which he belonged to. I didn't. But he did. He belonged to everything. And he'd sit there and tell me that that lunch with me between Christmas and New Year's every year was the high point in his year. And I'd sit there and bawl like a baby. Fabulous man. Never got kicked out of anything. But how he must have hurt. How he must have hurt. So I had to come to see that it's not possible for you and for me to decide how much somebody else is hurt. We don't know what's going on inside of somebody else. And they might have hurt 10 times, 100 times worse than I. And here I was sort of pitying them because they couldn't love this thing as much as I did. Also, I knew very well that when people didn't practice these principles like I thought they should, they couldn't stay sober. Our book tells us we cease to fight anything and anybody, or everything and everybody. We cease to fight. We had an old boy in our group in Beverly Hills that fought everything and everybody. He was a year and a half sober when I got here. And he's a year and a half older than I am in the program right now. And he never did quit fighting. He still fights, and he's practically a dead man. Now, back in the old days, I used to try to make him speak to me. And he wouldn't do it. Maybe a whole year would go by. We were in the same group. And I couldn't make him speak to me. And I'd do sort of stuff like this. I'd walk up to him in the middle of a sentence, talking to one man. Because he'd have to, you know, have to do something. Well, he did. He turned on his heel and walked off without even finishing the sentence. I couldn't make him talk to me. And when I got my 21st birthday, he gave it to me. And this roughneck kissed me on the neck when he gave me my birthday kiss. He may be one of the guys that loves me the most in this town now. So, we have to come to see that it isn't where you are, it's where you came from. Now, Eddie just might have grown 10 times more than I did in this program. But he didn't start even with me. He started down the ladder a ways. And so we have to come see these things. And it makes for much, much, much more beautiful living experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there's a little verse in the book which I won't quote because the doctor don't want me to. But it says this. It says, blessed is he who condemneth not himself in that which he alloweth. Blessed is he who condemneth not himself in that which he alloweth. What does that mean? I believe it means that if you can do a thing without condemning yourself, it's not so bad. But if you condemn yourself for it, you better jolly well quit it. It'll kill you. And I think this is one of the greatest differences between a good old Saturday night drunk and an alcoholic. Because you and I condemned ourselves from the beginning. Now, if we were raised in a religion that did not condemn us for moderate drinking, maybe we didn't condemn ourselves for moderate drinking, but we condemned ourselves for a bad performance. So from the beginning, we condemned ourselves. I knew better than to drink before I ever took my first drink. I condemned myself from the first drink. And as time went on, the condemnation became hatred. And we end up hating our guts. We can hardly look in the mirror to shave. Because of self-loathing. Blessed is he who condemneth not himself in that which he alloweth. Now again, this tells us this. That there's no particular way that you can classify so-called sin amongst those people around you. Many people can do things that I can't do and don't condemn themselves at all. Personally, I could do things, many things, 5 years ago that today I cannot do. And so it depends on where we are, what we can do, and what we have to get rid of. And it's a continuous process. Because the higher we go, the more we have to discard. And the more we discard, the freer we become. It's amazing. There's no such thing as the meaning of a word. Now this blows my mind. And the way it came about, I got thinking some time back that the first 2.5 pages in chapter 5, which add up the end of C to about 450 or 60 words. That's all there is in there. I never counted them, but I think that's about it. And I have gone through that not less than 25 and probably near 30,000 times in 29 years. And you might say, well, that must be the driest reading on the face of the earth. It's not last week's dishwater, it's last year's dishwater. But it isn't. They're always new. Every time I hear them, they're always new. Every time I read them, Every time I talk about them, they're new. The words remain the same, but we don't. And it depends entirely where we are, what they mean. And they will always be more meaningful. They always take a new meaning, depending on where we are. And we'll be walking up this ladder forever, world without end, amen. Now here's another thing I liked to think about, sitting up there on my hill. I believe that I'm right in this, and if I'm not, one of you sailors can correct me. I think that when you're sitting in a boat at water level, on a clear day, the horizon is 7 miles. I think that's as far as you can see when you're at water level. Now I'm up maybe 1,000 feet above the water level. And on a clear day, my horizon is almost limitless. 150 miles, I can see. Sometimes, Catalina Island, San Clemente Island, and Point Firmin are all close enough that I could seem like I could skip a rock to them. You know? Just that little bit of elevation changes the horizon from 7 to maybe 150 miles. And we'll be walking up these stairs forever. Now, the only thing we can't change about our lives, the only thing that cannot be changed by us, is that we're stuck with ourselves forever. World without end, amen. Now, this is a bleak prospect, isn't it? You get to thinking about committing suicide, you know. You can't make it. You can't make it. You're stuck with you forever. Everything else in life you can change. You don't even have to go home from here if you don't want to. You can go someplace else. You don't ever have to see your wife again if you don't want to. You never have to see your kids again if you don't want to. You don't have to stay in California. You don't have to stay in the United States. You can change everything in life but one. You can't get away from you. You're stuck with you forever. I'm stuck with me forever. Now it would appear that when we get here,